Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump campaigning as a Christian televangelist, with his piety in contrast to the porn he is facing on April 15th in the New York hush money trial, along with his cruel display of racist hatred yesterday before a group of uniformed cops calling for a bloodbath, labeling immigrants as animals. Joining us is Ryan Cooper, managing editor at the American Prospect and the co-host of the Left Anchor podcast, as well as the author of the new book, How Are You Going to Pay for That? Smart Questions to the Dumbest Questions in Politics. We will discuss his latest article at the American Prospect, The Pious One, Donald Trump, the least likely embodiment of Christian virtues in American life, is practically running as an evangelical minister. Then we'll look into an article at the New York Times by Thomas Edsel, Trump's backers are determined not to blow it this time around, about the more than 100 conservative tax-exempt organizations that have joined forces in support of Donald Trump and the MAGA agenda, forming a $2 billion-plus political machine. Joining us is Dr. Lawrence Rosenthal, who is quoted in the article. He is the chair and lead researcher of the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies and the author of Empire Resentment, Populism's Toxic Embrace of Nationalism. He has taught at the University of California, Berkeley in the Sociology and Italian Studies Department and was a Fulbright professor at the University of Naples in Italy. Then finally, we'll assess the military and intelligence failures of AFRICOM in West Africa, whose partnerships with Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Niger have blown up with coups conducted by officers trained by the U.S. who have invited the Russians in while kicking out the French and threatening to kick out the Americans from a billion-dollar base and operation in Niger. Joining us is Tommy Miles, a West Africa history enthusiast, independent scholar, author, and recovering academic who is writing a history of Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Ryan Cooper, the managing editor at the American Prospect. He's the co-host of the Left Anchor podcast, as well as the author of the new book, How Are You Going to Pay for That? Smart Answers to the Dumbest Questions in Politics. And his latest article at the American Prospect is The Pious One, Donald Trump, the least likely embodiment of Christian virtues in American life, is practically running as an evangelical minister. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Cooper.
Glad to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there's clearly an extraordinary contrast between Trump campaigning as a Christian televangelist with his piety contrasting to the porn he's facing on April the 15th in the New York hush money trial. But just yesterday, he really displayed his cruelty and racism and his hatred before a group of uniformed cops calling for a bloodbath, labeling immigrants as animals. So how is this not penetrating the Christian followers of Trump, and particularly the Christian nationalists? I guess maybe they're unreachable, but just regular Christians who, for whatever reason, see this guy as their champion. At the same time, he spews such unchristian hatred, cruelty, and racism.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the only conclusion you can come to is that these Christians either don't read the Bible or they read it very selectively. You know, the reason I read the Bible is when I was growing up in high school. I was in a rural Colorado, actually in Lauren Boebert's district. And there were a lot of evangelical types or conservative Christians and who were always sort of, you know, telling me that I was going to go to hell if I didn't do X, Y, Z. And so I cracked open the Bible, you know, so that I could be more of a troll, basically. But you read it and the stuff that Jesus says is quite radical. You know, it's like Jesus was a friendly dude. He was all about ministering to the poor, the sick, the needy, you know, miracles, healing the lepers and the other ill folks, you know, the loaves and the fishes, giving people free stuff. And the, you know, the things advocated by Jesus in the Bible were unrecognizable to how my conservative, quote unquote, Christian, you know, debating opponents behaved. And I think this is sort of the logical endpoint of this, where, you know, you're reading like bits of the Old Testament and like the really bloody wars and stuff like that, and just sort of indulging your base instincts and love of cruelty and oppression, and claiming to be, you know, inspired by God because of reasons. It's crazy.
Well, I've often said on this program that, sort of half joking, that Trump is the Antichrist. But I'm not sure that it's a joke. I mean, in your article, you end up with 2 Thessalonians, where Paul is saying that Jesus cannot return for the end times until the man of lawlessness is revealed, who will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped. This lawless man will use all sorts of displays of power through signs and wonders that serve the lie. But ultimately, the man and his followers will be destroyed. All will be condemned who have not believed the truth, but have delighted in wickedness. So there's no point, I guess, in going through all of the Ten Commandments that Trump violates routinely. But that's pretty uncanny, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if I were a believer, you know, I've often thought that one thing that would maybe help the, you know, the social fortunes of regular Christianity, like the mainline Protestantism, would be a revival of, you know, some sort of like energetic, you know, fire and brimstone condemnation of sinners and unbelievers. I mean, you look at Trump and like, this guy is just a horrible person. Like, he might be, you know, top 10 worst individuals in the entire country in terms of his behavior and his criminality and the horrible influence he's had over the country and over the his followers. You know, it's like he's given his followers, you know, permission to be the worst versions of themselves, to be cruel and indulge their most base instincts gleefully, you know. Yeah, you know, the sort of Antichrist narrative, people, you know, sort of argue about how coherent it really is. There's a number of passages you can point to, and they're kind of semi-contradictory. But like, the basic thrust of it is, you know, when the end times happen, in order for the end times to happen, there first has to come a guy who will deceive a bunch of people. He will set himself up as God. He will claim to have God's blessing and take his place in the church. And so, you know, once that happens, then the apocalypse can happen, Armageddon, the second coming and all that stuff. But, you know, look at this nominal Christian, this guy who, you know, walks right up to be saying that he is personally chosen by God. And his followers are constantly saying it, too. You know, Steve Bannon said it the other day. He's like divinely inspired. And like, that's something the Bible is very clear. You are not allowed to say that. You know, like that is a danger sign, and it's explicitly warned about in those passages, not just 2 Thessalonians, but that this guy is going to claim, you know, some sort of divine right. And whenever somebody says that, you be wary, because he's, you know, some kind of deceiver or the Antichrist or maybe even the devil.
Well, of course, he recently said that he's pro-God. And he was holding up his $60 Bible or $59.99 Bible.
The blasphemy of that.
I mean, but his attitude towards his flock, to his followers, is one of barely disguised contempt. I mean, if you really watched what he was saying, you couldn't help but feel he really thinks they're a bunch of stupid rubes.
Oh, undoubtedly. I mean, selling a public domain text with like a Lee Greenwood song and the Declaration of Independence or whatever, for $60, you know, it's a sort of soft cover book. I mean, you get a, you know, they'll you can get a free copy of the Bible. Just take one out of a hotel room. You know, they're designed to be taken. That's the whole idea. And the golden sneaker thing. It is this rebranded that sneaker that somebody else made. Trump didn't have anything to do except putting it his name on it. The whole point is to fleece his followers. And the same thing is true of his Truth Social IPO that happened the other day. The whole point of that, absolutely worthless company that's not going to exist if there's any sort of business logic attached to it, is to fleece his gullible followers for money to pay for his hundreds of millions of dollars in legal penalties and legal bills. And, you know, the fact that they just lap it up, you know, honestly, my sympathy is limited. You know, at a certain point, I tend to conclude they're asking for it. And that's what 2 Thessalonians concludes.
So what can be then done to mobilize the real message of the Bible and the lessons from the prophet Jesus?
Well, you know, that's a difficult question for me. I'm not a Christian believer myself. You know, I think that, you know, well, one place you could start with would be Joe Biden. You know, Joe Biden talks about his faith a lot, but it's a fairly muted type of thing. And, you know, I think that, you know, maybe for people who have sort of fallen away from their churches, it could be a good idea to sort of like try to rediscover that, you know, if you didn't stop believing, but instead just kind of like got out of the habit, you know, for folks like that in, you know, leadership positions to sort of stand up and ask that these religious institutions behave as the way that they're instructed, you know, to care for the sick, the needy, the people in prison. Even Jesus says that you have to visit the prisoners, or you go to hell. It's a very radical message. And I think that if it's a packaged in an inspiring way, like Martin Luther King, for instance, whose sermons I think are absolutely splendidly motivating and brilliant. It's a powerful message, and in favor of peace, freedom, justice, and all the other good stuff.
Well, your article at the American Prospect, Brian Cooper, "The Pious One, Donald Trump, the Least Likely Embodiment of Christian Virtues in American Life, is Practically Running as an Evangelical Minister." You mention that Jesus, of course, was taken into the wilderness by the Spirit of God for 3 days to be tempted atop a high mountain, and the devil showed him the kingdoms of the world. "All this I will give you," Satan said, "if you will bow down and worship me." And Jesus replied, "Away from me, Satan, for it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him." So this is a key passage, isn't it? Because the Trump cult, it's idolatry worshiping Trump. And the idea that he's somehow captured the Bible and turned it into an American religion, you know, Christianity is a universal religion. Jesus wasn't an American. I mean, I don't know where the blasphemy begins and ends here. It's just reeking of blasphemy and idolatry.
Yeah, Chris Hayes interviewed a guy, Doug Padgett, who's a pastor and an activist who has a group dedicated to trying to basically turn the evangelicals away from the dark side. And he has had some success at that, I would say, I should note, to your earlier question. But, you know, his argument, or his experience rather, with the evangelicals that he's talked to, it's like, why do you support Trump, given that he's so grossly immoral? How can you get behind this guy? And their answer is basically Donald Trump came along and said, vote for me and I'll give you power. And that's what he did in the form of Supreme Court justices that overturned Roe versus Wade. But as you say, that is basically a point for point retread of the temptation in the wilderness story. You know, like, you're not supposed to throw your principles away for the sake of momentary political power. And that's not, you know, especially for something like abortion, that's not even well established in the Bible. Like, Jesus doesn't say don't have an abortion anywhere. It's not mentioned at any point. He does say very explicitly, you have to care for the sick, the poor, the stranger, the needy, the prisoner. You know, it's like, why does abortion get all of that attention and not like the, you know, tens of millions of poor people or uninsured people in this country? It's a, you know, question of priorities. And I think, you know, it tends to suggest that you know, whoever wrote the Bible was onto something. You know, what, how does it profit a man to gain the world but lose his soul?
Right. But these anti-abortion people get a moral free ride. They care about the fetus, but not about the children. And they cut funds for children and food stamps and child tax credits, and governors of Republican states refuse free federal money for feeding and health care for children. So the evidence is overwhelming that these people are frauds. So I don't know. It's shocking. Any last thoughts here in terms of, we've established the hypocrisy of it all, but I don't quite know how it's going to be defeated. And I certainly, I'm not waiting for the Antichrist. I've already seen him, and I want him to go away.
Yeah, I would just say as a closing comment that, you know, I think it's pretty shameful that a lot of like secular media people basically treat these claims at face value, that like Trump supporters are the real authentic representatives of Christianity in this country. You know, they call themselves that, but there are a lot of other people who are diametrically opposed, who do not support Trump, and who actually try to take the, you know, the theology as outlined in the Bible seriously. And I think it's, you know, time for people to start taking that back.
Well, Ryan Cooper, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And Ryan Cooper is the managing editor at the American Prospect. He's also the co-host of the Left Anchor podcast, as well as the author of the new book, How Are You Going to Pay for That? Smart Answers to the Dumbest Questions in Politics. And his latest article at the American Prospect is The Pious One, Donald Trump, the least likely embodiment of Christian virtues in American life, is practically running as an evangelical minister. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into an article at the New York Times by Thomas Edsel, Trump's Backers Are Determined Not to Blow It This Time Around, which is about more than 100 conservative tax-exempt organizations joining forces in support of Donald Trump and the MAGA agenda, forming a $2 billion-plus political machine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Lawrence Rosenthal, chair and lead researcher of the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies and the author of Empire of Resentment, Populism's Toxic Embrace of Nationalism. He has taught at the University of California, Berkeley, in the Sociology and Italian Studies Department, and was a Fulbright professor at the University of Naples in Italy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Lawrence Rosenthal.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us, Lawrence. And obviously, your ties to Italy would suggest to me that you studied Italian fascism. And there's lots of analogies with Trump, who sort of sometimes looks like Mussolini. So just to touch on the fact that you are at the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies, how do you see the F word relating to the current political situation with Trump's capture of the GOP?
It's an interesting question. If you look at post-World War I Italy, and fascism is founded in 1919, immediately after the war, and actually comes to power in the March on Rome in 1922. It's 3 years. It's less than a presidential term. What Mussolini was successful in doing was transforming the kind of conventional view of Italian politics, which pitted as a kind of bipolar universe, that it was a question of what were then called the liberals against the socialists. And Mussolini found a word to conflate the two into one category, which he called neutralists, because both of those forces had been against getting involved in World War I. And so he redefined the conventional bipolarity by saying that those two are no longer the basis of contestation. Instead, they are one thing, and we, the fascists, are the other. Trump has done something quite similar. If you recall, in 2016, he was as critical of the previous Republican Party and Republican presidents as he was of Democrats. The word to conflate the two of them has become globalists. And so Trump has managed to reproduce the transformation of conventional politics as they are conventionally viewed into placing himself as one pole against the combination of the pre-Trump Republican Party and the Democrats rolled into one. There is that, if you're looking for analogies. I think that's an important one because it's kind of structural, goes to the heart of things. And if that bipolarity, the new Trumpian bipolarity of kind of anti-immigrant nationalism versus liberal democracy, if that maintains itself, American politics will be transformed for a generation. Beyond that, in my view, the real historical precedent of January 6th in this country was the March on Rome in Italy. This happened in 1922, and the circumstances were that this was a parliamentary government. The government would be named, as in Britain these days, by the king. And there had been an election. Mussolini was by no means the leading vote getter. But what he did is he created a situation where tens of thousands of his followers, kind of in uniform, they were called black shirts, descended on Rome when the king was obliged to nominate who would be the new prime minister. And essentially, they intimidated him by force of numbers and threats of violence into giving Mussolini the opportunity to become prime minister. And he would create the fascist state, a form of totalitarianism, a word, both words were created by Mussolini, totalitarianism and fascism. Fascism often said nothing outside the state, everything inside the state. And he would rule for 20 years and take Italy into a ruinous war. But January 6th was a similar thing, which is militant followers of Donald Trump at the moment at which the American legislature, that is to say, Congress, was going to determine who the next head of state is. This was an attempt to intimidate it, to intimidate the Congress into giving the nod, as it were, to someone who, in this case, had not won either
The popular vote
a
or the
popular vote or the electoral vote.
right. So let's move then from the Orange Duce and the analogy that you made that is absolutely very, very telling to an article in the New York Times that's gotten a lot of attention by Thomas Edsel. Trump's backers are determined not to blow it this time around. And It's about a rare display of unity that has more than 100 conservative tax-exempt organizations joining forces to support Donald Trump and the MAGA agenda, forming a $2 billion plus political machine. So he's obviously learned from January the 6th, and he's going to do it better this time around. So you're quoted in it, but let's broaden out your quote and talk about the two versions of fundamentalisms that have shadowed the Republican Party for 100 years. That's the free market fundamentalists and now the mixture of Christian nationalism and right-wing populism.
Okay. From the time of the New Deal forward, there has been a point of view which essentially was violently opposed to the New Deal and the creation of a welfare state, and has been attempting to take over the Republican Party ever since. These are the people I call free market fundamentalists. Now, in 1980, Ronald Reagan comes to power, and a version of free market politics comes to the fore in power in America. But this was a point of view which tended to trim back the welfare state and was anti-union and anti-tax. But that wasn't enough for the fundamentalists, who wanted to return America to pre-New Deal, pre-welfare state, and sometimes pre-progressive era, which means go back before the income tax, back to the world of, say, President McKinley at the turn of the 20th century. And those people were frustrated by Reaganism and the Republican Party, who would count on their votes, but not really deliver what they wanted. That agenda is now called deconstruction of the administrative state. And that's what the agenda, which is often called Project 2025, of the prospective incoming Trump administration sees as their goal. You can often hear somebody like Steve Bannon back in 2016 talking about, even when he was in the White House for his brief period for 9 months, talking about deconstructing the administrative state, which means essentially the whole panoply of federal agencies that administer things like Social Security, Medicare, food stamps, and it goes on and on.
Right, but they've been successful, haven't they, Lawrence? They've got the Supreme Court to do exactly what Steve Bannon called for.
That's true. There are cases in front of the Supreme Court which will decide questions of... Franklin Roosevelt was able to get the beginnings of the welfare state through the Supreme Court by a reinterpretation or a novel interpretation of elements of the Constitution, which allowed for the creation of these agencies. The current Supreme Court has been kind of cultivated, as it were, to put those novel interpretations of the 1930s into question. So they have come up with novel legal theories like, you know, some issues are too big for the agencies to decide and only Congress can decide, and various legal theories of that nature. And at the same time have managed to create both a Supreme Court majority and a kind of legal infrastructure that will produce not only the judicial personnel to make these kinds of resolutions, but also a kind of army of people, loyalists, largely lawyers, who will take over the agencies and carry out the agenda of essentially turning them down, turning them off, as it were. Okay, so that's one fundamentalism. The other fundamentalism is what we see on the, let's call it the populist right. And for them, their affiliation with this Project 2025 agenda is highly emotional. And for example, these are the people who, following Donald Trump, do not call this the deconstruction of the administrative state. They call it that America's enemy, internal enemy, is the quote unquote deep state. And this different, shading of the question allows for the kinds of extreme conspiracy theory mongering that fuels much of the populist right. In this moment, a large portion of the populist right is a reflection of what's commonly called Christian nationalism, which is the conviction that this is a Christian country. That is to say that the very founding documents, the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, were actually the work of Christian, often it's said Christian pastors in the colonial period. But in any case, this is a Christian nation, and the fear that motivates this Christian nationalist populism is that that's going away, that America is as a multicultural place, and that's in politics, in culture, and so forth, is taking away that specialness of an identity of America as a Christian nation. And so the coming together of these two fundamentalisms, the roll back the federal government to pre-New Deal era, combined with the idea that we want to renew America as a Christian nation and beware of quote unquote replacement by outsiders like immigrants, those two have come together and are the ensemble that is cooking up what is in store if there is a Trump administration in 2025.
Right. So it's a combination of moral authoritarianism and laissez-faire capitalism. And the players are Leonard Leo, who's got $1.6 billion to play with, the Heritage Foundation leader, Kevin Roberts, and his Project 2025, and a whole slew of players. The Club for Growth, of course, wants to shrink the government down to the size where you can drown it in a bathtub. So they're all come together. They've got about more than $2 billion to play with. What do we do, just here in closing, to stop this? Or what? This is a tyranny of the minority, with a minority of dark money funding it. So what does the majority, the silent majority, do to stop this coup, this fascist takeover of America?
Okay, just as an aside, I think it's more complicated than simply saying fascist takeover. I responded to your questions about fascism at
Sure.
the start, but those were analogies. Fascism, which, isn't out of the question, but it's not equivalent.
Sure.
We'll
What
just leave it at
definition
that.
would you have, Lawrence?
Novel authoritarianism. something that is modeled on what's called illiberal democracy. And the best examples of it are places like, well, above all,
Orbán's Hungary, yeah.
Orbán's Hungary,
Right.
and to some extent, Putin's Russia.
Right.
But this is sort of getting into the political scientists' weeds to talk about whether it's fascism or not.
Sure, but let's focus on what can be done because they're well
Okay.
funded and they're determined. And there is, as Liz Cheney said recently, we're sleepwalking into dictatorship.
Okay. There is a plain and simple answer to that, and the plain and simple answer is voting. That is the obligation of the forces, as it were, the Democratic Party and et cetera, to make sure that the urgency, the almost unique urgency of what faces us is conveyed in such a way that people turn out. And I find myself thinking, especially young people turn out at a level, sort of that we saw in 2020 and to some extent in 2022. But there are elements of the Democratic coalition which often in the past have been less than reliable as getting out the vote. And this year has particular problems. Above all, I think Gaza, in which a large part of the Democratic coalition, and this is particularly significant, it appears among young people, may come up with the view that because what is going on in Gaza is so reprehensible and so kind of unbearable that I just couldn't vote for Joe Biden. Somehow that is something that the Democratic world, that blue America, has to respond to with the conviction that by not supporting Joe Biden, by, for example, not voting, you are inviting in something that will make Joe Biden look like a picnic in the park.
Well, Lawrence Rosenthal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Lawrence Rosenthal, who's a chair and lead researcher of the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies and the author of Empire of Resentment: Populism's Toxic Embrace of Nationalism. He has taught at the University of California, Berkeley in the Sociology and Italian Studies department and was a Fulbright professor at the University of Naples in Italy. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing the military and intelligence failures of AFRICOM in West Africa, whose partnerships with Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Niger have blown up with coups conducted by officers trained by the US who have invited the Russians in while kicking out the French and threatening to kick out the Americans.
Hold the world around, he would tear our union down, but our union's going to break them slavery chains. And our union's going to break them slavery chains. I walked up on a mountain in the middle of the sky, could see every farm and every town. I could see all the people in this whole wide world. That's a union that'll tear the fascists down, down, down. That's a union that'll tear the fascists down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Tommy Miles, a West African history enthusiast, independent scholar, author, and recovering academic who is writing a history of Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tommy Miles.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the United States has suffered enormous setbacks in West Africa, along with the French. And just recently, the head of AFRICOM, General Langley, testified to the Senate Armed Services Committee, saying that during the past 3 years, national defense forces turned their guns against their own elected governments in Burkina Faso, Guinea, Mali, and Niger. And he went on to say these juntas avoid accountability to the people they claim to serve. But what General Langley did not mention was that at least 15 officers who benefited from American security cooperation and training have been involved in 12 of these coups. And in fact, the last five leaders of the July coup in Niger received U.S. assistance, training, etc., when they overthrew the country's democratically elected president. And then in turn, they appointed five U.S.-trained members of the Nigerian security forces to serve as governors. So here the United States is training these guys who ended up conducting coups with the help of the Russians. So this is a major setback. So what's going on here? It seems like a massive intelligence failure on the part of the United States military and intelligence services.
Well, I would argue that yes, it's a massive intelligence failure. I wouldn't necessarily lay it solely at the feet of the U.S. military or intelligence services. Those figures about U.S. training, those really need to be taken with several grains of salt. We're not talking about people who've been at the School of the Americas or anything like that. You have to understand what Langley's AFRICOM is. And I preface that by saying it's really two different beasts. There's been a lot of very good writing about AFRICOM's really waist-deep involvement in Somalia and the spillover from that in East Africa. In West Africa, AFRICOM has long been a military headquarter seeking a mission since its creation in, 2004, 2005. And one of the things that they do is that they have these large annual training exhibits, essentially. Morocco hosts a big one, then there's the Flintlock for West Africa. And what they do is try and get every African military officer they can get their hands on to come and receive free training. And there's not much to the training, you know, what can you do in a week? But it's mostly a proof of concept to show, hey, we're a valuable part of the U.S. military. We're valuable in this global war on terror. We're doing all this stuff. Don't we need a bigger appropriations? Don't we need to continue to exist as a separate command, which they previously obviously didn't? And don't all these generals need to have jobs that will project them higher up in the pecking order? So these guys in Niger, they're training from the U.S. for most of them. It's not true for all of them. For most of them, most of their foreign training came from places like Morocco, but also from the French. And French training generally involves long stints at Saint-Cyr or other military academies. So when we go back and correlate, oh, well, this person was trained by the U.S. and this person was trained by the U.S., we have to say, did they do a week at Flintlock? Well, yeah. I'm not sure either the argument that U.S. values and some great moral code are going to rub off in that, or that nefarious U.S. plots or turning people into coup makers for us happens at some place like Flintlock. So what the intelligence failure has been, and there's been I'm heartened to see a growing academic consensus around this in Western countries, because I think it's understood in West Africa, is that the counterterrorism strategies of French and the US in the Sahara and West Africa and the Sahel have been a failure, have made things much worse, have not tackled the roots of these problems. I noted last week that Professor Alex Thurston, who writes on these matters, has a forthcoming publication in which he argues something like that, that he's teased. And Hannah Armstrong, who is a quite good analyst who used to work for Crisis Group and, you know, every sort of star organization, has a piece that just came out today in the International Policy Institute blog that folks should check out, that argues essentially this, that U.S. counterterrorism strategy did nothing but militarize the conflict, pour more guns in. And the growing violence that continues to grow since the French 2013 intervention grows under the auspices now of an independent Malian state and its Russian allies, aid partners. But really, the strategy is much the same. The shackles may have come off a little bit, and we can talk about what shackles maybe the French or the U.S. put on the Malian government during their time in charge. But the counterterrorism strategy of just go in with guns is not going to solve this problem. Now, one last caveat, ultimately, that's for Malians to decide. And one of the problems here is that Malians really feel, in large part, that they haven't been in a position to decide these things for their own country. And this is part of the reaction you see in the growing rift between the U.S. and Niger, is that the Nigerian generals, certainly, but also much of the Nigerian population, though it's contested, of course, believe that, you know, they've been following a French or a U.S. strategy for all these years, and they aren't able to make these decisions on their own. They're not able to make military decisions on their own, but also political decisions. Imagine, if you will, if Corsica took up arms and declared its independence, and some the U.S. showed up and told France, well, no, you really need to negotiate with these people. You shouldn't get involved in a military struggle with them while they, you know, the rebels were burning towns and villages. There's a lot of pent up frustration and anger and a belief still, I think, from all of these military elites in Burkina Faso and in Mali and Niger and more broadly, that the solution here is a military solution. And until that passes, I don't see these wars ending in any solution that lasts more than a few years.
So let's talk about the U.S. Air Base 201 near the town of Agadez in Niger. The U.S. has poured $250 million into that outpost, and they've poured $1 billion in training, etc., for the local militaries in this neighborhood. So what was all that money about? Where did it go? If it didn't, if they had these guys had a week's training, you know, what happened to the billions?
So the Agadez base is a really good example, second only to sort of French counterterrorism strategy, of what went wrong with the post-2013 Western military involvement. The Agadez base isn't particularly interested in the security of Nigerians. The Agadez base is about flying drones over the Libyan border and into southern Tunisia and all along the Sahara and having eyes in the sky for this whole area for the U.S.'s global war on terror. Now, that said, in Niger, unlike Burkina Faso, and certainly unlike Mali, the U.S. government had, we know only because of its failures, ride-alongs with Nigerian troops. We don't know how long that went on. We don't know the extent to which that happened. We do know that another command, SOCOM, was operating all through Saharan Africa through all of this period, and we don't really quite know what they get up to and what they do. It hasn't had the effect on bringing peace in any particular way. Now, the Nigerians, the CNSP government has been quite clear, especially because they're almost all drawn from high to mid-rank Nigerian officers, has been very clear that they haven't found the U.S. intervention in the 201 base, the 101 base in Yamei, or the purported CIA base in Dirku in the Northeast, haven't found that as being particularly helpful to their war aims. Now, the Nigerians have a very different task from the Malians. They're not only essentially fighting part of the Malian civil war, in the West, they're also fighting the Boko Haram insurgency that's spilling over the borders from Nigeria in the south and the southeast, as well as facing small bandit groups that operate with relative impunity at the borders of Libya, borders of Chad. So they're feeling that, okay, the U.S. is here and they're going to give us some help, but they're only going to give us some help to go after the people on the U.S. Global terrorism watch list is, I think, one of the clearly articulated sources of frustration by this officer group.
Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and there's a number of questions I have, one of which is there a standoff now between the U.S. and the Nigerian military who want the U.S. out of that base 201, and the U.S. so far is not saying what they're going to do. There's also the role of the Russians, who have benefited from all these coups. Now the Wagner unit has been taken over by the GRU military, Russian military intelligence, the same group that were behind these assassinations, and now CBS's 60 Minutes just on Sunday revealed that they're behind the Havana Syndrome targeting of American intelligence officers to take them off the field, to essentially neutralize them because of health effects. So that's a pretty grim situation. And then the other point is that I recently spoke about the French involvement, where Macron is getting more assertive against Russia, particularly sending troops into Moldova and possibly into Armenia. And this is supposedly, I was told, payback for the Russian successes in the Sahel, where they've essentially helped drive out the French. So the French are going to say, okay, you took us out of Africa, but we're going to cause mischief close to home for you as payback. So could you answer those three questions quickly?
Yeah, so quickly, the last, I mean, I think is very indicative of French government leadership, political class thinking about this. I think it's probably fiction. The Russians really didn't drive the French out. The French drove themselves out. The French are extremely unpopular, and for reasons going back to colonialism. The economic situations of these countries, we've had a development model that essentially has never developed these countries under the aegis of French protection. And that's certainly how people in Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger, and in the future, we will probably discover Chad as well, view French involvement. So yes, it probably makes the French feel better to say that, well, this is really a war with Russia that we're fighting in the Sahel, but that saves them from asking some hard questions about their own relations with these governments. As with the United States, there are a lot of black boxes here. We simply do not know what the U.S. government wants in Niger right now, and we certainly do not know what the CNSP wants from the United States, wants from Russia, wants from the Iranians, who've been brought in to have meetings with CNSP leadership, all of which looks really calculated to create a crisis with the U.S., but not one that I really think is going to ultimately end in all U.S. forces leaving. I think those relations are probably too valuable. But the CNSP is mostly motivated just by its own survival. And because anti-French sentiment is incredibly popular in Niger, as in its neighbors, we're beginning to see the first use of anti-American sentiment, perhaps well-earned, but still. And it's really an open question how much these sort of right-wing military leaders really believe this or know that it's popular. The problem is, from an analysis from abroad, simply knowing that it is popular with the Nigerian street should tell us something about needed changes in relations in the future.
Well, let's just quickly touch on the Russian angle, that Wagner now has been taken over by the GRU unit, the very head of which is behind the assassinations in, as 60 Minutes just revealed on Sunday, the Havana Syndrome targeting of American intelligence officers abroad to basically disable them because of whatever these energy beam weapons were used. Yeah. So that they're apparently being very effective, and also they basically ending up capturing the mineral rights. So they're just as colonial, if not worse, than the Europeans, the French and the Americans, but they seem to be welcome. And you just mentioned the Iranians are showing up. Well, that's a red rag. That's a red flag if ever there was one.
Well, all of these countries, Niger may be a slight exception, have had close relations with the Russians for 70 years. So they found a way to balance those relations, even in the midst of the Cold War. The Traoré regime in Mali had very close relations with the Russians and close relations with the French and the United States. So there are ways of doing that. As far as the Iranians, all of these countries have good relations with the post-79 Iran governments and have for a long time. They're trotting out those relations now. As they're trotting out those relations with the Russians, as you mentioned, the Russian intelligence official in charge of the reorganized Wagner organization had high-level meetings with Niamey in the last few months. We really don't know to what extent these are looking for some aid. We've seen how useful that aid has been in Mali, the taking of Kidal, which was long considered impossible, was accomplished in a matter of a month or two. Now, I don't know how much of that has to do with any sort of magic from the Russians as to the shackles coming off the Malian military, and those shackles coming off, including, we should add, human rights violations, which happened under the French, of course, happened with U.S. involvement as well, but are happening now with Russian involvement. We'll see to what extent the Nigerians are holding these sort of relations out as a negotiating tool or as a plural strategy to maximize foreign involvement from any actors, and to what extent the United States is willing to go along with that. They have been in Central African Republic, for instance, which had a Wagner involvement, but the U.S., through diplomatic back channels, has managed to get U.S. aid and, in fact, U.S. armed guards in helping that same government. And this is just in the last 6 months to a year. So there are mixed signals from Washington about where their red lines are. What Niger seems to be doing right now is declaring where their red lines are and rather clearly saying, we'll meet with anybody we want. We'll have relations with anybody we want. It's going to be up to the US and sadly no longer the French because they don't really have any say in the area anymore. Up to the U.S., how they deal with those red lines.
Well, Tommy Miles, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Tommy Miles, who's a West Africa history enthusiast, independent scholar, author, and recovering academic, who is writing a history of Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media, and please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again on Sunday with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. My quiet voice was singing something to me, an angel song about the home of the brave and this land here of the free. One time, one night. One more light goes on.